Buse's percussive guitar duo with fellow acoustic guitar virtuoso Walter Strauss and Jack West's slide guitar ensemble, celebrating the release of two albums, Guitars on Life and Essential Curvature. More info and tickets available at CatalinaJazzClub.com and KPFK.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week, we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. Because we want you to know a little bit more about Feminist Magazine, who we are and how we do it, and why you'll want to support feminist radio on the air on KPFK every week. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like.
Hugging herself in an old kitchen chair, she listens to you heard on your radio. What do you think she knows of despair?
Poetry is a political act. In Fountain Theater's West Coast premiere right now, of Poetry for the People, the June Jordan Experience. And the question posed is, what does resistance sound like? Well, it sounds like this West Coast premiere is certainly one of the ways that resistance comes alive on stage in performance. And we're joined today by two guests to tell us more about this show. We've got Adrian Torf, who is co-deviser and composer, and she and June Jordan were both artistic collaborators and life partners for 19 years, and together created numerous works for performance. And we've also joined by Mackenzie Mondag, who is part of the ensemble. Mackenzie is an actor, singer-songwriter, and she trained at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. Welcome both to Feminist Magazine.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So, Adrian, I'd love to start with you. And I know June Jordan and her work are well known in many circles, you know, as a woman who believed that poetry is a political act. She's known in Black and POC and activist and poetry circles and in LGBTQ communities. But for those listeners who might not know, can you give our listeners just sort of a brief description about June Jordan and a little bit about her work?
Certainly. June Jordan was one of the most widely published American poets and writers and essayists of the latter 20th century. She was born to Jamaican immigrant parents, grew up first in Harlem and then in Brooklyn, in Bedford-Stuyvesant, and went on to have careers in urban planning. Something that's referenced frequently these days in exhibitions and papers about Afrofuturism. She then taught at a number of universities, Yale, Sarah Lawrence, a long stint at SUNY Stony Brook. And in 1989, she was lured to the West Coast by UC Berkeley, where she spent the last years of her teaching career and her life. I think it's fair to say that June is more widely known now than she was during her lifetime by far. I think because her work reflects an intersectional perspective that has become, I think, the native perspective to generations that have followed her. Mm. And so, yes, she is well known among POC communities and African-American communities and LGBTQIA communities. She is also very well known among literary communities, communities of poets, communities of activists of all ilk, and in many parts of the world.
Thank you. That's a beautiful encapsulation. And to talk about collaboration and how the two of you collaborated. What did that look like when the two of you worked together, and how did that evolve into this show that we're talking about here?
The collaboration started in 1983. We were on the same program in Minneapolis. I was playing for a singer named Linda Tillery, and June was in the area as a poet in residence at McLaren College. The producer invited her to come. She heard me play, and afterwards she asked to meet me. During that conversation, she let me know that while her poetry had been set to music and she had enjoyed collaborations of different kinds, notably, I think your audience would be familiar with the work that June and Bernice Johnson Regan did together that was made well known by Sweet Honey in the Rock. The famous 7-Day Kiss song is June's lyric. Ought to Be a Woman is June's lyric. Leonard Bernstein set her poetry to music, as did others. Her invitation to me at the time was that we actually conceive of a piece together rather than having somebody set to music a poem that she had finished. We did that originally with June living in Brooklyn and me living in Oakland, California. So for the first months, we would exchange ideas by telephone, by audio cassette, through the U.S. Postal Service, because in the 1980s, we didn't have the technology that allows the kind of conversation we're having right now, for instance.
Right.
And when it became clear that this was going to take on a real and very serious life of its own through actually conversations, meetings we had with both Leonard Bernstein and Joseph Papp of the Public Theater in New York, I moved to Brooklyn, and June and I then proceeded to live life together and collaborate from there.
And then from there, in a way, this show is a continuation of that collaboration. I know you co-devised it with Raymond Caldwell, but in a sense, you're collaborating with the legacy work, right?
I think that's an interesting framing. I might say that this show came about not through my own initiative, but because Raymond O. Caldwell, the artistic director and my collaborator, beloved collaborator, learned about June as he was preparing to stage the opera that June and composer John Adams and director Peter Sellers had created together, an opera called I Was Looking at the Ceiling and Then I Saw the Sky. It was originally planned for performances in 2021, but the COVID pandemic made it impossible. So Raymond decided that in order to fill the slots in the performance schedule that he had, he really wanted to find out more about this June Jordan. He, you know, John Adams is widely known as a composer for opera in this country. Peter Sellers is widely known for his productions and direction, but June was less known. That, though, was who Raymond really wanted to know more about and to bring to his audiences. So he got in touch with me. And in the process of our simply talking and my feeding him information and pointing him in direction that he could find resources and original material around June, as well as anecdotes that I could provide, we very quickly fell into creating this stage piece that was originally produced in 2022 in Washington, D.C. through Theater Alliance, won a big deal award in 2023 for that production. So we reprised it in D.C. in 2024. Then Raymond moved to the Fountain Theater in Los Angeles, and we're fortunate to have a run of it again this year. The piece is comprised of June's writing, poetry, memoir, essay, interviews. It's multimedia. People in the audience get to really see and hear and feel June's presence. Mm-hmm. And there is also in the piece what some people said at June's memorial service, notably Adrienne Rich, Angela Davis, Alice Walker, Bernice Johnson Regan. And all of that is performed beautifully by this crew of six actors.
Well, speaking of the six actors, Mackenzie is part of this ensemble, and this is, it sounds like there's live music, there's movement, it's mm-hmm. all illuminating this life mm-hmm. and the depth of June's writing. And how does that feel as a performer to be part of an ensemble in that way and bringing that all to life?
That's a really great question. It's so interesting. The six of us in this ensemble, we are all of different ages and different backgrounds, but we sort of come together and speak June's words. And it's, especially right now in this time in the world and in this country, it feels almost like kismet to be able to speak June's words to an audience. And I think what's been the most interesting experience is seeing these people receive it, because they themselves maybe knew her name or had maybe heard a couple poems but didn't understand the depth of her work and what she was speaking to, speaking truth to power. And so I think for the six of us, it's just been an incredibly moving experience. And I think we feel very lucky to be doing this work right now.
Yeah, absolutely. The timing seems so relevant and necessary, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I mean, what I know of June's work is it's about how we move to, in many pieces of her work, how we move towards collective liberation. Mm-hmm. And that was part of earlier waves of movement building, and maybe some of it got forgotten, and it's being re-remembered now in new forms. Does that feel right to you, Mackenzie?
It does. It's so interesting being on stage and speaking, say, her poem, Menace to My Enemies, or Moving Towards Home, and feeling as though time is like overlapping, because it's cyclical. What I'm speaking and what she wrote decades ago is what is happening right now. And I mean, I'm getting chills just honestly thinking about it. But yeah, it's, I don't know how I could say this again, but I feel just so lucky. And I think the six of us just feel so lucky that we get to have the opportunity to speak through her. And, you know, we embody her in the show. We get to embody June. We get to embody her mother, her father, her collaborators, her students in this torrent of poem and movement and song and history. And it's really something that I have never experienced before in my life.
It sounds so remarkable. And Adrian, for you, how does it feel? I know this is the second run that it was in DC, but to see this all come together in this, what is clearly a very joyful, but also, as we were saying, incredibly relevant piece of work.
It's joyous. And that's not a word that I often use. On a very personal level, it means that June is no longer a memory for me. It means that June is alive, not only in her own work, but in the performances and the hearts and the brilliance of these six actresses, as well as the people in the audience. Because one of the things that the audiences get to do in this production that is new to the LA production is that, guided by the Poetry for the People, A Revolutionary Blueprint, which June and her students from the early days of Poetry for the People at Berkeley compiled, the actors invite and encourage and support the audience through the process of writing during the performance. And the audience writes and shares poetry on the spot. I have been able to watch the audience from my seat at the piano and seen people's resistance melt because of the way that Raymond has crafted those portions of the performance, and because of the way that the actors relate and connect with the audience in a beautiful way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That sounds so on track, so sort of aligned with her work and the way she taught, right? And I know that the whole Poetry for the People program was a groundbreaking shift in the way of teaching poetry. So, Mackenzie, how does that feel each time when you have to take that leap and bring the audience in? I mean, that's each time must be a little different and exciting.
Every time it's a little different, but every time the six of us, I think, are so wowed and surprised and impressed by people's ability to just jump, fearlessly jump off the cliff and explore something new. Every single time we've done the show so far, there have been at least three or four people that have shared something that they've written in the span of maybe collectively like 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And it is so, so powerful. Just last night, a woman shared a poem in Espanol, in Spanish. And after the show, our castmate, America Covarrubias, she translated it for us. And it was so, so, so moving. I am always wowed by people's ability to just open their hearts and write something in the moment, in the spirit of what June was actively living in her time, fearlessly, mm-hmm. by the way. So yeah, it's been crazy. It's been surprising. It's been exciting. And I am just so utterly moved and impressed.
It sounds like you're all sharing in this experience.
Yes.
Every single time mm-hmm. you do this performance. I love there's a quote in a press release from Raymond Caldwell where he talks about June reminds us that love must be at the center of every revolution. And we're channeling her joy, her rage, and her uncompromising vision. And I love that quote because there was a wave of time where rage was uncomfortable and not allowed or encouraged in political activism. And I feel that we're coming back to understanding how rage can be channeled so effectively. It's a very effective form of energy. Adrienne, how do you feel about that in the work?
First, I want to say that I think Raymond O. Caldwell is brilliant, and not just because of that quote, but I think that's evidence of his brilliance. And anyone who comes to see the show, I think, will get to see a much broader span of his creative brilliance on the stage and how he's incorporated all these elements, as you say, Mackenzie, as you do. I think rage is a very important point for us to touch on in two ways. June, as you said, believed in not only liberation and justice, but the point of it all. The point of it all was that we would all have the opportunity, the possibility to love as we love, whom we love, for the reasons that we love. And that's often forgotten in political activism. Why are we doing this? There's a line, it's more than a line. I think we have a video, a segment of video of June in the show saying, talking about women and women in the movement and what we all actually know and need to call out, which is that women are the ones that get things done. And women are the ones, and I don't think I'm verbatim, but close to verbatim quoting her. Women are the ones who remind us why we are fighting this fight. We are not fighting this fight in order to fight. We are fighting this fight in order to reach a place of tenderness. That's what drove June. Rage, where does rage sit in all of that? And particularly, where does rage sit in the depiction of a Black woman in the United States? I have not needed to be adamant with Raymond O. Caldwell, but in anybody representing June in any context that I have been allowed to influence in some way, I have been adamant about asking people to be careful that they are not blending this unfortunately popular meme of the angry black woman with the very human, righteous need to be angry when faced with reasons to be angry. And we all have reasons to be angry. So, you know, in the six actors and Raymond and I in rehearsals, we were all mindful of the fact that the way the actors project in order to get to the last seats in the audience and stuff, be done in a way that relies on what Mackenzie, you and the other five know how to do so beautifully, which is through breath support and opening the mouths and everything, which mm-hmm. is a very different kind of projecting than screaming, which is so often akin to expressing rage. Because I don't know that anybody wants to yell a love poem, and there are love poems in the show. I don't know that anybody wants to scream, "I was born a black woman, and now I am become a Palestinian." What we want is for people to hear that. We want them to hear, "I must become a menace to my enemies," and to understand that those statements are fueled by June striving for justice. Mm-hmm. Anger is something that's on the other side of a net, and it asks people to hit it back. That's not what June was about. Mm-mm. June also, people who don't know June, who come to the show, will quickly learn that June had an absolutely infectious giggle. She was what some would call adorable. She was loving. She was funny. She was fly. She was all kinds of things. And when she was given a reason to be angry, she was angry as any of us would be.
Thank you. Thank you for framing that as in the way that it all comes together.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fund drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give us $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so we do a monthly payment. You choose how much. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories.
Call 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK.
From February the 10th through March 6th, join KPFK 90.7 FM for our winter fund drive. As a listener-sponsored platform, we remain one of the few places on the dial where the airways belong to the people, not corporations. In honor of the Black History Month centennial, we are featuring the profound insights and historical recordings of the giants who shook the foundations of injustice, including James Baldwin, Malcolm X, Angela Davis, Dr. Cornel West, and so many others from the Pacifica Radio Archives. Your contribution keeps our independent signal alive and preserves these revolutionary voices for the next generation. The number to call is 818-985-5735, option 2, or pledge online anytime at kpfk.org/donate. Donate today and let your voice be heard.
What do you think would be a surprise if the world was as willing as she's able, hugging herself in an old kitchen chair? She listens to your hurt and your rage. What do you think
We have been talking to Adrian Torf, co-deviser and composer, and Mackenzie Mondag, both from Poetry for the People, the June Jordan Experience. So the show has been running since January 31st, and it's at the Fountain Theater through March 29th. But to talk about a couple of the special performances that are coming up, there are community conversations that take place every Fridays. And what do you hear from the audience? What is the kind of feedback and questions that you get?
We were able to sit in on the community conversation this past weekend. And the amazing poet who spoke before the show this past Saturday was the amazing and incomparable Tiffany Snow, definitely someone that people should be checking out. And she led the conversation afterwards. And it was, I think, something that's warming my heart about this show is that it is creating community. It is creating places for people to come and talk and express and be vulnerable. I mean, experiencing this show is vulnerable. We're asking people to be vulnerable. And so in these conversations, this past weekend, we had people sharing the poems that they weren't able to share during the show, which we do ask them to share their poetry aloud if they're up to the challenge. But people got up and they shared their poetry. Some people got up and did spoken word, not something that they had written that night, but something that had been sort of weighing on them that they wanted to release. And it is just this gorgeous coming together of people and of minds and of commiseration, but of also inspiration and a sort of positive anger and a positive energy of what, of how we want to move forward, especially right now.
Especially right now. Yeah. Absolutely. So there also are two special performances that I'd like to mention for our listeners. The performance on Friday, February 13th is Blackout Affinity Night, which is an opportunity for audiences who self-identify as Black to experience the performance together in a safe and inclusive space. And then Tuesday, February 24th, the production travels to Berkeley for a one-night special performance. Can you tell us about that, Adrian?
It's a homecoming. June's the last 12 years of June's life were spent in Berkeley. She loved living in Berkeley. She was a fully tenured professor at the University of California at Berkeley, and many of her students still live in the area. And so it's, you know, it's just what Raymond and I do. And I have to say, the Departments of African-American Studies, Professor Nikki Jones, Department of Women and Gender Studies, Professor Paola Becchetta, have been strong, strong partners in bringing this production to Berkeley. We do have the performance with the Los Angeles cast and myself at the Freight, formerly Freight and Salvage, but the Freight on Tuesday night, February 24th. And the university, the two departments that have partnered with us, African American and Women and Gender Studies, are producing events on campus, some of which are also available to the public, some of which are happening in classrooms. The two that are available to the public are a celebration of the book This Unruly Witness, June Jordan's Legacy, that was released about 2 months ago, with people who have contributed to that collection reading from it. And the other is a panel on Poetry for the People, its legacies and its futures. And that panel will consist of people who were program coordinators while June was running the program, and then who ran it after she stopped teaching and after her passing, and Aya de Leon, who then led the program for many years after that. So those are both open to the public, and we can provide a link to information about all three of those events.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll make sure to connect links to that on our website for you. So all of these things, celebrations and nurturing inspiration, I feel, coming out of this. In Los Angeles, folks can see Poetry for the People, the June Jordan Experience, at the Fountain Theater, the wonderful, famous Fountain Theater on Fountain Avenue at Normandy. And all tickets are actually name your price, which is a remarkable community-based theater situation. And folks can go to fountaintheater.com for those tickets. Can you tell us, Mackenzie, what nights again you're performing so people can start planning their schedules for this and make sure to see it while the show is on the run here?
There are Blackout Affinity nights on Thursdays. We have matinees on Sundays, shows on Fridays and Saturdays at 8 p.m. Community conversations are on Fridays. There are many opportunities, though, to see this show. And I would say this is very, very important work to see. This is something that I think the people need to see right now. They need June Jordan in their lives at this point.
I think that's a great way to wrap up our conversation. Folks need June Jordan in their lives. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be getting together a group of friends to see this, other writers and activists, because I feel that might be the way to see it together. We've been talking about Poetry for the People, the June Jordan Experience, and it's at the Fountain Theater in Los Angeles. And it absolutely sounds like it's an experience. Adrian, what would you like people to walk out of the theater with if you had one or two feelings, concepts that you'd like them to leave with?
A belief that all the love that they want in their lives is possible, and that it will take collective, activist, creative, loving efforts to get there. The other thing I want them to leave the theater having experienced is the really remarkable work of Mackenzie and the other five actresses, and the work of Raymond O. Caldwell, who I will say again is a beloved collaborator for me. And I hope they'll walk out of the theater saying June Jordan's name and feeling like they did actually get to know her. And to your point, Mackenzie, that she's a part of their lives now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you both. Thank you both so much for sharing your stories and the experience of creating this remarkable piece of work with us. And we will have links to this show on our socials and our website. And we have been talking to Adrian Torf, co-deviser and composer, and Mackenzie Mondag, both from Poetry for the People, the June Jordan Experience. Thanks both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
What do you think is the soul of a knowledge? What do you think that makes her feel safe? Biting her lips and lowering her eyes to make sure there's food on the table. What do you think would be her surprise if the world was as willing as she's able? Hugging herself in an old kitchen chair, she listens to your hurt and your rage. What do you think she knows of despair? What is the aching of age? The father, the children, the brothers.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK, and make your pledge. Or you can go to the kpfk.org website, click that big red donate button. It's easy. Keep public radio strong here in Southern California by donating to KPFK right now And you can become a member today or renew that membership you've let lapse. You can go to kpfk.org, donate, or 818-985-5735. And this Black History Month, we have some amazing thank you gifts. Today, we want to tell you about, for a $150 pledge to KPFK, we will send you a unique Angela Davis pack. This is a copy of the book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, Ferguson, Palestine, and the Foundations of a Movement, plus almost 2 hours of Angela Davis live in Watts. And this is a unique recording. It was recorded by KPFK, speaking right here in Watts. This is local. This is from our archive. And that combined with a book for a $150 gift, this will be our thank you to you. This book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, is so worth owning. It's collected essays, interviews, and speeches by the world-renowned activist and scholar Angela Y. Davis. And she illuminates the connections between struggles against state violence and oppression throughout history and throughout the world. So call 818-985-5735. Pledge $150 support for KPFK and Feminist Magazine, and we'll send you this book and the MP3. In the book, she's reflecting on the importance of Black feminism, intersectionality, and prison abolitionism for today's struggles. She discusses the legacy of previous liberation struggles, from Black freedom movement to the South African anti-apartheid movement. She highlights connections and analyzes today's struggles from Ferguson to Palestine. So all you have to do, call 818-985-5735 and pledge for $150. Or you can get this thank you gift as a sustainer. You can pledge $15 a month for a year and you can get this gift. In both her book, Freedom is a Constant Struggle, and also in that speech in Watts, she's talking about how we're facing a world of outrageous justice. She challenges us to imagine and build a movement for human liberation. And in doing so, she reminds us that freedom truly is a constant struggle. So you can be reading that book, listening to her words. All we ask is that you pledge a gift of $150 and we'll send that to you. Call 818-985-5735. 818-985-KPFK.
What do you think is the soul of the knowledge? What do you think that makes?
Sometimes when you listen to KPFK during a fun drive, you might feel that maybe your contribution wouldn't really be enough to make a difference. Well, let me tell you something. Every contribution is important. Whether it's a single $25 gift, installments of $25 per month, or more, every listener's financial investment is valued. You depend on us to stay abreast of the news of the day, to know what's going on in our community, our nation, and around the world, to offer great music and cultural programming. And we depend on you to help provide the funding that makes it all happen. Every pledge is important. Every donor is important, no matter how large or small the contribution. So call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Press 2 to go to the call center or go to kpfk.org 24/7 and pledge securely online. We appreciate every contribution, especially yours.
Monday morning, streets are bare.
Many of us knew Buddy Reed Soskin as the oldest park ranger in the United States, and likely the world. But she was so much more. She was also a mother, a grandmother, an entrepreneur, a writer, a singer, a songwriter, and by all accounts, a trailblazer. Betty Reed Soskin was the great-granddaughter of a woman who was born into slavery. She knew segregation firsthand, and she knew that history was documented, told, and remembered by who was sitting at the table, telling, remembering, and documenting it. Betty Reed Soskin died on December 21st, 2025, at the age of 104. And though she's no longer with us to tell her stories in person, her legacy is sure to live on for generations to come.
I'm Betty Reed Soskin, and I guess I am maybe the star of this, the whole thing.
And you are 102 years old.
I am 102 years old.
What's your secret?
There is no secret.
During her living years, Betty Reed Soskin frequented KPFA's airwaves, speaking about voting, white supremacy, the rhythm and pace of social justice and change, and finally, the power of music.
Ain't no turning back now. I done signed my name to freedom.
When Betty Reed Soskin authored her first book, Sign My Name to Freedom, in 2018, I interviewed her at her first public book signing.
My voice may be so atypical, with such an atypical story to tell.
That's Betty Reed Soskin reading from her memoir, Sign My Name to Freedom.
I'm still working my way out of feeling as though racially I'm nothing, but I finally decided that in fact I'm really everything. And it's a wonderful thing to be, after all. At least that's the way I see my beautifully blended grandchildren.
Betty Reed Soskin said she preferred to be called by just her first name, Betty. As she said, it was her subtle way of challenging the system of patriarchy and living her life on her own terms.
I was married at 20 to Mel Reed, a man who I met at 14. I was 14, he was 17. He was, at that point, I think, in his senior year at the University of San Francisco. That marriage lasted for about 35 years, produced four children, and ended when I was about 49, late 40s. And my second marriage was to Bill Soskin, who was Dr. William F. Soskin, an illustrious professor from the University of California, research psychologist. That marriage made me a faculty wife on the university campus, and I got a non-traditional PhD, which we called the pillow PhD. That was an amazing period of travel and exposures that I grew in off new edges that I didn't even know existed before then. All of those men, my father, whom I loved dearly, my first husband, and my second husband, all died in the year 1987, within 3 months. And I had been completely defined by the men in my life. I had no idea, because I didn't go to college, which meant that I had never had life as a woman before I became a mother. So that period that you people who are on campus live, I had never lived through until I was 50. And it wasn't until that period of intense grief for about 3 months, and then right behind that was this burst of emancipation. And I've been spinning in space ever since, being Betty the individual, being the woman in me. And I think that now that I'm 96, I have the distinct feeling that I'm being all of the women that I ever was. Right now, that I'm using everything that I ever had, everything that I ever learned, and that each of the women that I have been is triggered either by songs, by something I read, by a snatch of music, by something one of my kids says, and all of the affect of that period comes. It has led to a 96-year-old, very, very rich life, because I'm in all of those women right now.
Retirement to Betty is a fallacy.
I keep asking at the park, you know, when are you going to have the what are we going to do with the old lady meeting? And they keep saying, not yet, Betty. So I think that I'll probably work until I don't want to work anymore. But I think that, that retirement is a kind of a fallacy. If you want to do it, fine. I'm not sure that I could have done it because I was a late starter. I didn't have my first significant job until I was 50. I raised four kids to adulthood before I had a job. So that I'm a late bloomer. So that I'm still catching up.
And that connects to my other question. Yeah. Sometimes people will say that they had some dream or they had some vision and it's too late. They didn't do it. And what do you say to
them? I know. I am living my entire life in a constant state of surprise. I am still having first experiences at 96. I have sat in a conference room at the park and had a Skype session with a class of juniors in Eugene, Oregon. I participated in a panel at the annual flower show in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. As long as life is unfolding for me, I don't see any reason to retire.
So the moral of the story is, it's never too late.
No. Keep your resume polished up.
Because you always reinvent yourself, I never end an interview without asking you the most important lesson that you've learned on your journey thus far. So what is it today?
That's easy. There is a place on the film that the National Park Service developed where a Rosie, who lives in Rossmore, and she says that period was the greatest coming together of the American people that she had ever lived through. And when the film was first released to us, I used to stand against the wall and watch the faces of the audience as she uttered those words. And I'd think, how can Agnes say that? She knows that isn't true. I've got to speak to that woman. And one day, after my 90th birthday, I was suddenly able to hear that that was Agnes's truth. And that there were many truths, that we all create our own reality, and that there are truths that rise out of religious conviction, and they rise out of education, they rise out of life experience, that many of those truths are in conflict, but nonetheless true. And I realized that as long as there was a place on the planet where Agnes's truth and mine could coexist, that that was going to be enough for me from that day forward. And for me, that's the park that I'm working at. And I get to share that insight with the 14-year-olds that come through, which I consider a real privilege. So they don't have to get to be 90 years old before they discover that. That probably is the most important lesson I've learned in the last decade.
The existence of multiple truths.
Yes.
After Betty retired from her gig as a park ranger, with the help of documentarian Brian Giebel, and her granddaughter, Aliana Reed, Betty raced with time to share a snippet of the undertold story of her musical career with the world.
Many of you know me as a park ranger, but there's a part of my life that I've kept hidden for half a century.
Little boy black,
I packed Secret Betty up in boxes in reel-to-reel tapes. No one in my life knew that I had been a singer or that I had written music. I talk about, you know, suffering a mental break, but I don't give anybody the reasons why. But the music saved me. It really did.
We were the first family of color in Walnut Creek.
Why must my mind?
And I think that had I known the price my kids would have to pay before we moved in,
just
I don't really know if I'd have put them through that.
Does my dream?
I was documenting all of those events that we were experiencing as a country and that I was experiencing in isolation. But they ring as true for me now as they did when I wrote them.
Feel the fire.
Maybe this releasing of the music to the public is a way of making myself whole. And maybe I need to do that before I die.
In 2024, I spoke with Betty, along with her granddaughter, Aliana Reed, and her daughter, Diara Reed, about the forthcoming film, Sign My Name to Freedom. Betty's daughter, Diara Reed, says that like most children, Betty's children might have taken some things about their mom for granted as they were growing up. Now, as a late bloomer herself, Tiara Reid thinks that late self-discovery and reinvention might run in her genes.
When she got into the Park Service, I was busy with the store. And I wasn't really, you know, kind of paying attention to who she was becoming, or she'd want to come and share about the, you know, the things that she was contributing, how important they were. And I was, yeah, okay, mom, okay, mom. I realize at this point now, watching her since she had a stroke in 2019, I had to become her caregiver, which terrified my former self. And I had just transitioned in August of 2018. So I was a real, real newbie and like very vulnerable and not very confident in my transition at that point. And I
and
was
then your mom had to readjust to you in this identity, right?
Yeah, I mean, my oldest brother was gay, so she knew about gay, but she didn't know about identity. It was something that she had to learn and kind of grasp. And, you know, she went through her mourning of David, and she didn't really know Diara yet. But we've been together for four and a half years plus. I was, like, taking over her local managering, her interviews and her career, which was booming. Even after her stroke, we've made trips together. And of the last year or so, everybody's been like, wow, you look just like your mother. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. I'm Lil Mel, you know? I'm like, no, that can't be. But then I started thinking about things. It says, my mom started her new career when she was 85. I started my new life when I was 66. So it's kind of like, oh God, is this in the DNA? This time I've been able to spend with her, I've gotten to know Betty as Betty and Betty as a woman. And I can appreciate just how she rolls. I mean, she's so unique and I can take so much from that. I've gotten to know her really for the first time. At this point, we're inseparable. We kind of like, you know, have the same heartbeat.
At the age of 66. You were transitioning into your identity as Tiara, right?
Right. I started my life at a late age too, just like she started hers.
Betty, what's your favorite thing about having Tiara by your side all the time?
I worry about her.
Oh, you worry about her?
I worry that my prolonged life is affecting hers, and that's something I hadn't anticipated.
I got time, and this is a time I need to cherish.
The late Betty Reid Soskin's granddaughter, Aliana Reid, who is also the daughter of Diara and is helping to produce the forthcoming film of Betty Reid Soskin's life as a musician, says her grandmother gave her a bigger vision of what it means to be a woman and how to push back against the invisibility that often happens to women as they age.
I think a lot of people my age were confronted with actual aging once we got to about our mid-20s. All of a sudden, we aren't the youngest adults anymore and have to confront like how we're going to settle down and what we're going to do with the rest of our lives. And this idea that we have to have everything figured out by the time we're 30, or set up in a way that by the time we're 30, we're pretty much settled down and ready when we get to our 40s. And we don't really think past that entirely. And to have this woman who has given us stories and materials of several decades of her life, and each decade being equally as rich, is so inspiring. I know, especially as a woman, with this idea that women have a shelf life, you know, around having children or desirability to stay young. And we kind of are in a time where we are especially pushing back around that. I think, you know, feminists and women in general, we've been pushing back about that for years, but I think I'm seeing a very special trend amongst my generation where things like having a life past 50 is inspiring and makes us excited about getting older, because that's just the cliche for women, is dreading getting older. And I think Betty is an amazing example to not be afraid of that.
Betty Reid Soskin was born on September 22nd, 1921, and died on December 21st, 2025, at the age of 104. Even if Betty Reid Soskin is no longer with us, her stories, her music, and her legacy promise to live on. Sharon Sobota, Pacifica Radio.
If I went to the courthouse and signed my name to freedom.
So you can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button. Or call 818-985-5735 or 818-985. You can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org, or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. And like that whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine. And that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. And it goes across generations too. To FemMag, because we believe in radio, go to kpfk.org and click donate if you want this to keep happening, to keep going, and these kinds of stories, this kind of work, to be there every week for you. We're inviting you to give $100 or be a sustainer. And that is amazing. You give us your credit card, you say how much you want to donate every month, and then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. So show us a little love, won't you? Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. So we're wrapping up another edition of Feminist Magazine. Thanks to all our guests and contributors today. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour, in the Feminist Magazine hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. Go to kpfk.org and click the donate button or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
From the Watts Uprising to the present day, KPFK has been at the heartbeat of the struggle in Los Angeles. This February 2026, we mark a monumental milestone, the centennial of Black History Month. 100 years ago, Carter G. Woodson gave us a week to honor our past. Today, we celebrate a century of reclaiming our narrative. As we celebrate this centennial, we remember that Black history is not a sidebar. It is the foundation of the American story. You're invited to join us throughout February as we honor 100 years of truth-telling. I'm Stanley Clark, and this is KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
There is no question that we are living in volatile times, and it's unclear what the future holds. That's why KPFK is holding a three-week public forum here on the radio to provide space for listeners to talk about what's happening in your world, what's happening in your country, what's happening in your state, and what's happening in your community. I'm Mitch Jezerich, and I'll be your host for these special series of broadcasts in which we want to hear from you through listener calls and emails, and you'll likely hear a little from me too. That starts on February 17th. A Tuesday at 10 a.m., KPFK's public forum, right here on 90.7 KPFK FM.